So I want to tell you about a book today. The book is called The Gulag Archipelago. You ready? The book is called The Gulag Archipelago, and it's by a Russian author, a Soviet author named Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was in the Gulag Archipelago concentration camp system for a very long time. He had a very hard life. He was on the Russian front when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in the early stages of World War II. Now, Hitler and Stalin had signed a non-aggression pact. And Hitler invaded the Soviet Union anyway. And from what I've been able to understand, the Soviets had prepared an invasion force for Europe at that point, but were not concerned with having to defend their territory, and so they were caught completely unawares by Hitler's move. And the conditions on the Russian front were absolutely dreadful, and Solzhenitsyn was a soldier on the Russian front. And he wrote some letters to one of his friends, which were intercepted, complaining about the lack of preparation and using bitter, dark humor to describe the situation. And the consequences of that was that he was thrown into a work camp. The Soviet system relied on work camps, and so those were large labor camps of people who were essentially enslaved, many of whom were worked to death, often froze to death, working in conditions that were so dreadful that they're virtually unimaginable. Solzhenitsyn spent a very large number of years in these camps, sometimes in a more privileged camp because he was an educated man, and sometimes in worse camps. He also developed cancer later and wrote a book about that called Cancer Ward, which is a brilliant book. So he had a very hard life. There's just no way around that. To be on the front and then to be in a concentration camp and then to have cancer, that's pretty rough. Now, he wrote The Gulag Archipelago. He wrote a book called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich first. That was published in the early 1960s. When there was a brief thaw, Stalin was pretty much out of the picture by the end of the 1950s. There's some indication that he was murdered by Khrushchev, and Khrushchev became premier of the Soviet Union after Stalin. And there's some indication, perhaps, that Stalin was either murdered by Khrushchev and a set of his cronies, or when he was very ill, just before he died, was not helped, at least, wasn't provided with any medical attention because of the intervention of Khrushchev and his cronies. Now, there's some indication as well at that point that Stalin, who was an absolutely barbaric in every possible way you could imagine, was planning to start a Third World War. And he was certainly capable of doing such things because he had already imprisoned or killed tens of millions of people. Now, just after Stalin died, there was a bit of a thaw in the Soviet Union with regards to internal repression. In the early 1960s, Solzhenitsyn published a book called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which was a story about one day in the life, his life really, inside one of these so-called Gulag archipelago camps. Now, he called it the Gulag Archipelago because an archipelago is a chain of islands. And so Solzhenitsyn likened the work camp system in the Soviet Union, which is made up of isolated camps distributed across the entire state, he likened that to a series of islands, and hence the metaphor. And One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich was one of the first publications released in the Soviet Union that dared make public what had happened inside these camps, at least initially. Now, that thaw didn't last very long, but that book had a tremendous effect. It's a short book. It's worth reading. After that, he wrote a number of other books, which are also, he's a great literary figure in the same category, I would say, as Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, which is like really saying something. You know, those two are perhaps the greatest literary figures who ever lived, with the possible exception of Shakespeare. He wrote this book called The Gulag Archipelago, which is published in three volumes, each of which is about 700 pages long. The first one details the origin of the oppressive Soviet system, at least in part under Lenin, and then its full-fledged implementation under Stalin, and the deaths of, well, Solzhenitsyn estimated the deaths in internal repression in the Soviet Union at something approximating 60 million between 1919 and 1959. Now, that doesn't count the death toll in the Second World War, by the way. Now, people have disputed those figures, but they're certainly in the tens of millions, and the low-end bounds are probably 20 million, and the high-end bounds are nearer what Solzhenitsyn estimated. He also estimated that the same kind of internal repression in Maoist China cost 100 million lives. And so you can imagine that the genuine historical figures, again, are subject to dispute, but somewhere between 50 and 100 million people. And one of the things that's really surprising to me, and that I think is absolutely reprehensible, is the fact that this is not widespread knowledge among students in the West, any of this. And it's because your education, your historical education, if you started to describe it as appalling, you would barely scratch the surface. These were the most important events of the 20th century, and they're barely covered at all in standard historical curriculum. You know of something, I would presume, about World War II and about the terrible situation in Nazi Germany and the death of 6 million gypsies and Jews and homosexuals in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. But my experience with students has been that none of them know anything about what happened as a consequence of the repression of the radical left in the 20th century. And I believe the reason for that is that the communist system had extensive networks of admirers in the West, especially among intellectuals, and still, in fact, does, which is also equally reprehensible. And I believe that one of the consequences of that is that this element of history has been under-examined, and certainly very little attention has been brought to it in the public school curricula. And there's absolutely no excuse for that. It was the worst thing that happened in the 20th century. And that's really saying something, because the 20th century was about as bad as it gets. And so, and the fact that these deaths on massive scale occurred, and the fact that we don't know that deep inside our bones is a testament to the absolute rot of the education system. So imagine, it's Russia. You're in a village. It's 30 years, something like that, after the serfs have been emancipated. There's a few agriculturalists who've managed to produce successful agricultural enterprises. And, you know, maybe they have a couple of cows, they have some land, they're able to hire a few people, and they're raising almost all the food, right? And so, and they're a minority in any village, because the hyper-productive successful are always a minority. So they're a minority in every village. All right, and so, and there's people who are doing worse, and then there's a lot of people who aren't doing so well at all. And then the communist intellectuals show up, and they tell the people who aren't doing so well, some of whom are just suffering because of life, but some of whom aren't doing well because they've never done anything productive with even a second of their life. And the communist intellectuals come in and say, you know those guys that are doing so much better than you? Yeah, they actually stole all of that from you. And you're morally obligated to go take it back. It's like, oh man, you know, after 6 cups of mead, let's say, or let's say 10, or let's say 20, and I'm drunk out of my mind, and I've got my cruel buddies with me, and we're all resentful right to the core because we've wasted our miserable lives, and now we have an opportunity to go, like, down the street to our wealthy neighbor's house and to rape his daughters, and we can do it in the name of good. It's like, well, there's a story you can market. And that happened everywhere in the Soviet Union. And so they wiped out the kulaks. It's like, great. And then 6 million Ukrainians starved to death.
Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant.
Yep. I'm a farmer.
Brilliant.
The Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Then it became a region pathetically unable to feed mm-hmm. itself. And yet, the same sort of worldview that gave rise to that, we're now being told, you use the word neo-Marxist. Many people in Australia use the word cultural Marxist. Mm-hmm. I've got an old friend who said to me, what are you talking about, John? You know, free capitalist Australia is not going to let that happen here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Qantas Airlines took a nice step towards that the other day, and they adopted their language policing policies. These corporations who should know far better let these far left fifth columns into their organizations. They think they're not going to pay for that. I think they're going to stop with some demands for the reconstruction of language. Not like the demands for reconstruction of language, by the way, are trivial. They're maybe the most important thing you could possibly demand, right? I want to reshape the way you speak. I want to reshape the way you think. It's like, well, that's okay, as long as it doesn't interfere with the bottom line. It's like, it'll interfere with the bottom line. You let that fifth column in. It's a warning to corporate people. You let that fifth column in, man, you're going to regret it. You're going to regret it. So, and things can turn on a dime, you know, a very well-organized minority, even if the majority opposes them, and they do. A very well-organized minority can have an unbelievably pernicious effect on an organization.
Margaret Mead's made that point. Mm-hmm. Society's changed direction when a small group of people decide to change its direction. That's the way history works.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened in the universities.
Let's come back. this issue of the redefining of language. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there are two things that people who want to reshape society in brutal ways do. The first is they start to silence good debate. Either silence it or shut it down or whatever. Second thing they do is they redefine language so it's very hard to have a debate. Mm-hmm. So diversity, actually, I mean, there's no other way to put it. In this country, it's rapidly coming to mean a stifling conformity. You mm-hmm. dare not deviate from the line. And you see it with a whole lot of other words that are bandied around, equality being one of them.
Yep.
Because it's confused. Equality of opportunity is confused with equality of outcome.
Well, the initial wedge was equality of opportunity, and then that flew, and so, well, no, it's equality of outcome. That's equity. And that's, I cannot believe how rapidly that idea, which is the ultimate and terrible ideas, I can't believe how rapidly that spread and how little people criticize it. Well, that's because it. To uninformed analysis, it sounds good if you're feeling carelessly compassionate.
Because you go back to the Ukrainian example, in destroying the leading edge farmers, you actually guaranteed misery for everyone.
Oh, unbelievable. People were selling human body parts in the Ukraine for food. You know, it was, if you were a mother and your children were starving and you went out into the fields after they were harvested and you picked up individual pieces of grain that the harvesters had left, and you didn't turn them over to the state, that was a capital offense, right? The funny thing is, that was in the glory days of the Russian Revolution, right? That wasn't in the, like, 1950s. That wasn't in the 1930s even. That was in the 1920s. That was right when this started. And I think it was Malcolm Muggeridge who was reporting on that for a UK newspaper whose name escapes me at the moment. He was pointing all of this out, you know? And no one paid attention to
him. No one paid attention. No. Towards the end of his life, he warned that the West is in danger of eating itself out from within. And I wonder whether, in fact, he wasn't being very prescient. Mm-hmm. And you and I want to stop that happening for the sake of our young people. For the sake of everyone.
Mm-hmm. We went down that pathway already.
We've tried it.
And things.
History should be like science in the sense that it ought to be objective. It ought to be told truthfully. It ought not to be used to secure some dominant group's preferred version of society.
Well, this is also why, see, what I've been trying to do about this, because I thought this through a long time ago, I thought, well, I think the group identity game ends in blood. It doesn't matter who plays it. Left-wingers play it, blood. Right-wingers play it, blood. And lots of it, not just a little bit. You can't play the identity politics game. Well, so what do you do instead? You live the mythologically heroic life as an individual. That's the right place to work. And that's the message of the West, as far as I'm concerned, is that we figured that out. We figured out that the collective identity was not the pinnacle statement, that the individual, not that collective identities have no value. Obviously, family has value and your organizations have value, all of that. That's not the issue. The issue is, what's the paramount value? What's the metric by which people should be measured? And the answer is, they should be measured as individuals, as if they have a divine soul. They should be measured in that manner.
But it can't be a selfish thing. That is to say, if I recognize I have worth and dignity, I'm obliged to recognize that so do you.
Mm-hmm. I think you can't recognize that you have intrinsic worth and dignity without also recognizing it in others. Mm. And vice versa. I don't think that I can recognize the worth of another person without stumbling onto the idea that I also have to recognize that for myself. When did you think, everyone would want that, but people don't, because you're also charged with the responsibility of your own care, as if you matter. Well, that's a big responsibility. Like, it's a lot easier to assume that everything is pointless. I mean, that's painful and all of that, but, well, you don't bear any responsibility.
And no one lives that way.
No. No, well, not for long.
Not for long. Well, not for long, exactly. But, you know, Voltaire's biographer, it wasn't actually Voltaire himself, it was a lady who wrote his one of the many biographies of him in the 1930s, came up with that adage summarizing his views, that I may disagree with you, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. There's a couple of things implicit in that that seem to be incredibly important. So I may disagree with you, but you have dignity and standing and worth and a right to put your view. That's the first thing. I'm respecting the other person.
Oh, you should crave it.
Yeah. And the second thing it implies is that it's the idea on the table that's important for two reasons. One is we need to have a debate about that, not attack the person who put it there, show some respect for them. The second thing is it's only by honest debate that you find the best way forward.
Well, that's the thing. That ties back to the discussion we had about the purpose of memory and the purpose of historical education. It's like, look, there's another rule in my book, which is Rule 9. Assume that the person that you're listening to knows something you don't. Well, they do. The person you're listening to knows some things you don't. You can be sure of that. Now, whether or not you can get to them is a different matter. But if you do get to them, it's a real deal for you. That's why you want to listen to the other person's arguments, is because you're not everything you could be. You don't know the pathway forward with as much clarity as you could. And it's possible, this is one of the wonderful things that I've had the privilege of experiencing as a clinician. You know, because people, it's like I live inside a Dostoevsky novel as a clinician. People come in and they tell me about their lives, and I listen to them and they tell me things that are just absolutely beyond belief, you know. And I learn from my clients constantly. They're telling me honestly about their experience. They tell me things they wouldn't tell anyone else because I actually listen to them. But part of the reason I listen is because I'm desperate to listen. It's like there's a possibility I'm going to do something stupid in the next 5 years that's going to be like fatal. And there's some small possibility that if we have a decent discussion, that you'll tell me something that will eliminate some of my blindness so that I don't have to fall into that particular pit. And if you have a good sensitivity for the depth of the pit, then, you know, you're pretty bloody motivated to avoid it. And so, and that dialogue is, it's dialogic, it's dialogos, right? It's shared logos. It's the way that we redeem ourselves mutually moving forward.
And it all depends on having the facts on the table as best you're able to establish them, not distortions of fact.
Not what you wish would be the case. At least your best approximation of what you think to be true, and not what you wish for. No one.
Because the new version of this seems to be, if I disagree with what you say, I'll paint it as hate speech, or challenging to my notions of diversity and inclusiveness, and I'll fight to the death your right to even have your say.
Well, that's why hate speech laws are so pernicious. It's like, and that needs to be taken apart. First question, is there such a thing as hate speech? Yes, obviously. People say terrible things, reprehensible things, quasi-criminal things even, all the time. Brutal, and some of them cause a lot of trouble. So the idea that there's hateful speech, it's like, yeah, okay, that's self-evident, no problem. Well, let's regulate it. Okay, fair enough, because it's hateful. You know, maybe we'd rather that there wasn't any of it. Okay, no problem. Who defines hate? Well, we'll worry about that later. It's like, no, you won't. That's actually the problem. Here's the answer to who defines hate. Those people that you would least want to have define it. That will be the inevitable consequence of the legislation. Because sensible people won't have anything to do with that. Like, people who are power mad will gravitate to that domain to make an ethical case to exercise their controlling power over the language of other people. No, and I've had journalists say, well, what makes you think that your right to free speech trumps the right of someone to not be offended? And I think that's really the level of our political discourse. Okay, so we'll run a little thought experiment. So I'm talking to one person, I'm talking to you, and the rule is I don't get to offend you. Okay, maybe we can still have a discussion about something difficult. But let's say I'm talking to 10 people and about an important thing. Now I have to make sure that I don't say anything, despite the fact that this is an important and contentious issue, that I don't say anything that offends even one of those 10 people. Okay, maybe I can even manage that. What if I'm talking to 1,000 people? there's going to be someone in that thousand people, there's going to be someone who's offended at the mere fact that I exist. So it's an impossible standard. It's like, well, you can't say anything offensive. Okay, fine. Then you can't say anything. Okay. So what? You don't get to say anything because no one should be offended. Well, then you don't get to think. Well, what happens if you don't think? Well, then you can't negotiate your way through the future, and you fall into a pit, and so does everyone else. So that's where that all ends up. You can't say offensive things. Equals, you cannot negotiate your way properly through the future. Equals, everyone suffers. Well, that's a bad strategy.
Thank you for watching this episode. We appreciate your support. If you value vital conversations like this one, be sure to subscribe to the channel there and also click the notification bell to stay up to date with new releases.